on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
Five Live.
It's Friday afternoon, the last Colin Murray show on Five Live before the return of Simon Mayo next week, who's usually supping down a big coffee at this stage because of the arrival of Mark Kermode, who's here with the film reviews. Unlikely setting, looking out on an international cricket pitch, watching a very important test to do it, Mark.
Is that what that is?
That is.
I was just going to say it's very lucky that you went to Pat first, because all that stuff he said with all the facts and figures, I was going to say that. Exactly. And then, so I just, otherwise I would have stolen his thunder.
Pat Murphy stole your notes to read that.
He did, I know. So have there been any goals? Is it shocking up?
Yeah, it's 3-0.
3-0.
We've done some good emails that have come in already I want to do before we even go near the box office top 10.
Okay.
Simon Lewis in Clapham says, permit me if you will to have a Kermode-esque rant. I'm a full-time dad, and entertaining my kids in the summer holidays has been tough. When I was growing up, the cinema was a great way of spending a couple of hours for both the kids and the parents. Of course, Simon, the old double bills as well. Anyway, he says, my dad still likes The Jungle Book and Indiana Jones, The Goonies. My mum is a fan of E.T. and Splash. But what do I have to watch? I've sat through Pirates 3, Shrek 3, Evan Almighty, Spider-Man 3, and now the truly rubbish Happy Never After. The Simpsons was the only one I thought was worth paying for. I did laugh at least 6 times. And next week, I have the joy of surfing penguins. And what has all this Oscar-worthy group of films cost me? Well over £180. I could have bought a DVD player and all the old favourites for that. Narrative Cinema has... I told you it was a Mark Kermode. Yes, Narrative Cinema has well and truly
died, kicked
the bucket. That's what Simon says.
It is definitely true that... I mean, I know everyone tends to look back on, you know, when they were kids, say, oh, everything was better then. You know, Punk rock was better than all this stuff that we have now and everything. But when I was a kid, on Saturday and Sunday, you could go to the cinema. It cost you, like, you know, 85p or something. And they changed the films on Saturday night. And you watch whatever was out that was a U or an A certificate film. And now, you look at the... And it is literally wall-to-wall digitized talking penguins and, you know, really, really terrible threequels and really, really terrible tie-in merchandise-led films that are all connected to some special offer with a burger. And you do
some
think, whatever happened to Great Children's Cinema? In fact, this time last year at the Children's Film Festival, London Children's Film Festival, they were desperately trying to address this and say, how do you get back to a situation when kids can go and see films like Cares? I mean, you cannot imagine somebody like Ken Loach nowadays making a film as good as Cares and actually finding an audience, because unless he put a digitised surfing penguin in it, nobody would go and see the damn thing.
Teddy Finn in Liverpool, this is a bit more specialised, we'll not dwell on this. Please ask Dr. Kermode what his singing contribution was to the book Paris, The Secret History by Andrew Hussey.
Well, okay, Andrew Hussey, or as I used to know him, Andy Hussey, we were at college together, we were in a band, and we went busking in Paris, and we bust an entire set of Velvet Underground songs in Paris. We did all right, actually, funny enough. And then years later, Andy became a very, very well-respected author, and he wrote this absolutely brilliant book about Paris. And I noticed in the thing, I get credited as doing backing vocals, and I spoke to him, I hadn't seen him for ages, and I said, what's that about? And he said, well, you know, I sort of felt it was a background noise, the memory of us busking in Paris was a background noise when he was making this book. But the best thing about it was that when he and I went busking, we were both very, very thin, and then we met up again and we're not very, very thin anymore and we were both able to enjoy the other's increasing size.
Well, listen, next time I'm back filling in for Simon, we'll maybe set up a little mic, a little acoustic guitar, we'll have one of the Velvet Underground tracks from
you. Do you play?
I don't know. Well, not well, anyway.
That's okay. The Velvet Underground didn't either. Maureen Tucker had never seen a drum kit before somebody sat her behind it. But she said that she gave the band something to come home to.
That'll do perfect.
Very good.
This week, then, the movies we'll look at, License to Wed, Rush Hour 3, Surf's Up, The Signal, The Walker and The Waitress. And first, the UK box office top 10. I'll go through them. We've talked about this before. Cash at number 10 didn't even have a preview.
Well, it hasn't been shown to us. It's a Bollywood movie. If anyone's seen it, please send us a review of it. It is listed on the IMDb as an action thriller, which could mean anything at all.
Okay, something to make you happy. Happily Never After at 9,
which they weren't overly keen on showing us either, and I think, as the previous email just said, it's absolutely terrible. It's one of those things, let's take a bunch of children's fairy tales, but let's mess them up and do it all postmodern and get that Sigourney Weaving, that'd be absolutely fine, wouldn't it? And it's awful.
Right, can I get a burger and a toy to go with that one? Is it?
I don't even think it's got a burger toy franchise tie in.
That's how
I think even the burgers went, I'm sorry, we're not having that stinking our place of work up.
That's good to see. The Hoax get in at number 8. You talked about this last week.
I like The Hoax. I like Richard Gere very, very much. It's really good to see him playing a sort of slimy, cheating, weird guy who pretends that he has become Howard Hughes' autobiographer. I mean, again, Richard Gere does only have that one acting mannerism, which is to blink, look down and exhale, and he does that an awful lot, but I like him doing it, you see. And I was really, really thrilled that the other week when we had on Alfonso Cuarón, and he said and agreed with me that the Richard Gere remake of Breathless, of Abu Dussouf, the great, some people think it's a great French movie, I don't think it's as good as the Richard Gere remake. It's actually a terrific terrific film. And if anyone hasn't seen it, go and see the Richard Gere remake of Abu Dussuf. It's fantastic.
No, I think my staunch defence of the first 10 and last 10 minutes of Die Hard 4.0 has kept it in the top 10. It's at number 7.
Well, it's on the way. I mean, it's done perfectly all right. It's obviously made all its money back. It's not a terrible film by any means. It does have a lot of sort of well-executed action sequences. It has no brains whatsoever. It has none of the sort of the charm of the first movie. But it's, I mean, I quite like Bruce Willis, but it is for, you know, Die Hard 4 pointless, and I'm amazed to see that it's hung on in there as long as it has.
Okay, we know they're making Shrek the 4th, so we'll move on from Shrek the 3rd. Yeah.
But that again, referring to your previous email, that's it. That's what we've got to look forward to in 2010, Shrek the 4th.
People still want to see Travolta dressed as a man at 5 and Hairspray, and at 4 is Evan Almighty, which is, as of course you said, you weren't a big fan, you have to say, the start of Bruce Almighty in the first place. No, Bruce Almighty, I thought was okay.
Bruce Almighty wasn't any good, you're wrong about that, but the good thing about it was that it did have Morgan Freeman in it as God, which was funny, right? Yeah. And I mean, I'm not a big Jim Carrey fan anyway, but it was Jim Carrey not quite doing The Truman Show and not quite doing Man on the Moon and not quite doing anything, and it wasn't great. But Evan Almighty makes it look like Citizen Kane. Evan Almighty is it's a really horrible movie. It's not funny. It's theologically unsound. It doesn't know what target audience it's aimed at, and it's badly put together. And it's terrific, terrific, terrific to see it not storming in at number one. Now, it may be that it has a platforming release, and it may be that they're going to open it wider next week. In order for it to know that it's really failed, we'll have to wait until next week. But it tanked in America, and it deserves to tank. The people that backed it deserve to lose money.
How much was it again?
175 million, which theoretically makes it the most expensive comedy of all time, and just goes to prove that comedy is not expensive. Really funny comedies are all cheap.
And it had turned over a coming out here in Britain. It had done about 110 million, hadn't it?
No, it was just pushing the 100 million mark, and by that point it had been out in America for 6 weeks.
Right.
So that means it had topped 100 million. Now, in order to make your money back in America, you have to make 2/3 of the total cost of the movie back within the first fortnight, and they haven't done it.
They haven't done that. Well, the top three is as expected. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix hanging in there. Not a bad film.
It's fine. There's an awful lot of the book that is skipped over, and there's an awful lot of ground that they try and cover. It is, incidentally, the shortest of the Harry Potter movies, despite the fact that it's an incredibly long book. I don't think it's brilliant, but I think it bodes well for the next, which is Half-Blood Prince, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And everyone apparently is now reading, well, of course, everyone in my family is now reading the final one. What's it called? Harry Potter.
Mate,
and
you're asking the wrong person.
Deathly Hallows. And apparently it's great. So I haven't read it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I mean, not looking forward to reading the book, obviously. I'm looking forward to seeing the film.
Yeah, Harry Potter leaves me close. I probably would actually rather see it number 2, the Transformers, your least favourite film.
Do you really hate Harry Potter now?
It just does nothing for me. Fantasy doesn't do anything for
me. I didn't get it at all until Prisoner of Azkaban, and that was it. That was a real eye-opener, and suddenly I thought, okay, I get this. There is something going on in that. And ever since then, I've been a bit of a convert. I still think those first two films, which are directed by Chris Columbus, are absolute, you know, accountancy filmmaking.
And we could probably just skip over Bay's Transformers and look at the Simpsons movie still at number 1. And it is interesting to see. I mean, I read that email out there that was, you know, from a father who said, look, I can't take my kids to see all of these particular films from Simon Lewis, but he does still say on that of them all, The Simpsons was the one that was worth paying.
It is, and The Simpsons, you know, at least there is, you know, the kids will enjoy the cartoon stuff in it. It's slightly rude, which is absolutely fine, and there's obviously plenty more going on for the adults. But I mean, it says something about the state of cinema at the moment that probably the best kids film around is The Simpsons movie, which isn't the kids film.
It must be worth pointing out, though, I suppose, if we look at the top 10, with exception of the hoax, but realistically never going to get near the number 1 slot,
no.
The Lesser of All Your Evils is the best selling film in the UK for the last 7 days.
It is. What, The Simpsons movie? Yeah, but you really love it. You know, you were totally sent from the word go. But even you thought it had slightly run out of steam.
What I thought it was a very good extended episode. And I think if you
and put it that, is overextended.
Yeah, and if you put that up against paying, you know, £7, £8 to go and see something that leaves you cold, you know what you're going to get with it. I think it's well worth going to see. It's a good experience.
But the only question is there any reason to see The Simpsons movie in the cinema? Could you not just wait for it to come out on DVD? Because presumably it's not like there's no moment in it when you think, wow, this is really cinematic. Unlike Team America World Police, when I was actually really pleased that I saw it in the cinema, in exactly the same way that I was pleased that I saw the first Thunderbirds movie in the cinema, and I was pleased I saw the first two Doctor Who movies in the cinema.
Well, I'm splitting hairs, but, you know, The Simpsons has a regular angry mob scene, and there's one part of The Simpsons movie where the entire Springfield community comes over the hill, and that's wonderful in the big screen.
Okay, so there's one scene that justified. How much is the cinema price now? £7.80?
It's nothing, £7.
Okay, so for £7 for the one crowd scene.
And you get the laugh. Eight,
but on DVD,
times,
you could have paused it. You could have paused it, and you could sit there and go, that's him, that's her, that's the other one, that's the pig in a hat.
I think £7's a lot to a lot of people. And to go out
but
and
not
see.
Not to you.
No, it's not. I would take £7 seriously. I took the tube to get down here today. But the point I'm making is, for a family day out, £7 ahead, if you're going to go and see the best loved piece of animation there's ever been and Homer Simpson and his family on an epic adventure, it's well worth the money.
Okay, I love the. I got the tube down here in the Joe Strummer man in the barricade.
Let me take out the tube. Yeah. I jumped over as well. I didn't
Did
even
you?
Pay on. Yeah, yeah. Let's have a look through some films then for you. Should we start with Rush Hour 3?
Yeah, because this will... I mean, this is the last of the threequels of the summer. And in fact, it was the one I think that was least expected and least anticipated. You know, obviously, there's going to be Spider-Man 3. Obviously, there's going to be Pirates of the Caribbean 3. Did we really need Rush Hour 3? Now, all you need to know about Rush Hour is here is the setup. Jackie Chan is an incredible sort of knockabout action star with a great sense of humour, yeah, who's been trying for ages and ages to really make his way in the English-speaking market. You know, he's made some Hollywood films. Although, funnily enough, Rumble in the Bronx, which is meant to be set in the Bronx, is actually filmed in Canada and is financed by the Hong Kong film industry.
Not cheaper there.
So the deal is, his problem is he's not great linguistically, but he is a really good sort of knockabout son. In fact, if you look at something like Around the World in 80 Days, in which he was paired up with Steve Coogan, I thought that film was very good, although it did very badly at the box office. So the answer to it is, let's pair him up with Chris Tucker, who is just about the most annoying motor-mouth comedian in the world. So we'll get Jackie Chan, he'll do the falling over stuff, and we'll get Chris Tucker, he'll do the talking really fast and being annoying. And so there's a number of things wrong with the film. One of them is Max von Sydow as a part in it. I keep getting asked about this. People keep writing in saying, what is it with your pronunciation of Max? Well, you know, it's spelled Max von Sydow, right? Who, of course, famously was the exorcist in The Exorcist. And Friedkin, who's the director of that film, refers to him as Van Sydow. And I once met him, and I said, how do you pronounce your name? And he said, well, how do you pronounce it? And I said, well, von Sydow. He said, well, officially, it's von Sydow. I've been trying to do that ever since, but every time I say von Sydow, it sounds like I'm making it up, so yeah, I kind of lapse into von Sydow every now and then.
You stick to your principles, you heard it from the horse's mouth.
Von Sydow has a cameo role in it, so I thought, okay, this is going to be fine. I like Max von Sydow, but even he wasn't enough to bring this out of, you know, the rubble. The big problem with it is this: I really like Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan is getting on a little bit in years. He's no longer able to do the incredible knockabout stunts that he once was able to do, and he was one of the best physical comedians around. I mean, in the same way as somebody like Harold Lloyd or Buster Keaton, he had an extraordinary sense. I mean, not only was he incredibly agile and a great martial arts star, but he really had a sense of physical comic timing. As he has got older, that has slightly gone away. Plus, you pair him up with Chris Tucker, who is not, as you were just saying when that clip was on, is not Damon Wayans, is not, you know, a really you know, great big steamrolling effective comedian. He's just that really annoying guy.
There's reasons to go and see it. You seem to not be saying to everyone that who would want to go and see this.
The people who would want to go and see it are Jackie Chan fans. Jackie Chan fans will be disappointed because it's not a great Jackie Chan movie. If you're a Chris Tucker movie, hey, you're going to be in heaven. But I mean, if you're a Chris Tucker movie, believe me, you need to go somewhere other than the cinema. You need to get help.
The Five Live Football Daily Podcast. All the day's football news sent direct to your computer. Podcast it now at bbc.co.uk/5live.
Before we go to Waitress, I've got a quick email here, which is about Evan Almighty, which we touched on again earlier. James Miller says it must be a bad film as it's advertised on buses. Surely that doesn't hold up. There are good films advertised on buses.
Well, there are many terrible films advertised on buses, because one of the things, if you've got a really bad film and what you want to do is, you know, you want to it's going to get kicked by the critics, you just you throw a lot of advertising at it. So all the mainstream block. But it can't be that. I mean, actually, Spider-Man 2, which I liked, had massive bus advertising. But then again, so did Sex Lives of the Potato Men.
I've got it. We just need to change one word. What?
Advertised on buses. That is probably true, but then somebody will now ring up and say that in fact Monty Python and the Holy Grail was advertised on the side of a bus. But let us know. I can't think of a good comedy that was advertised on the side of a bus.
Well, let's talk about Waitress. I know nothing of it, so I'm looking forward to hearing your review and all the details.
Well, an interesting movie. It's unfortunately, it has a sort of sad notoriety in it that it was written and directed by Adrienne Shelley, the actress and filmmaker who sadly died. And this has kind of lent a bittersweet side to it. I mean, it's very, very tragic that she's not here to see the movie doing as well as I think it deserves to do, despite some critical drubbing. The story is a young woman living in a hick town working in Joe's Pie Diner. She makes pies. She makes different type of pies that sort of reflect her mood. So some of the pies are called, you know, My Life is Really Rubbish Pie, and another one's called I Want to Leave My Cheating Horrible Rat Husband Pie. And at the very beginning of the movie, she discovers that she's pregnant. She then goes to her local clinic to meet her new doctor, who it just turns out is played by Nathan Fillion. Now, do you know who Nathan Fillion is?
No.
You ever see Serenity?
No.
Okay. Nathan, well, it, for anyone who has seen Serenity, right, Nathan Fillion is this very kind of lovely, you know, handsome, down-home, charming kind of guy. And there's a certain audience who think Nathan Fillion's, I really like him. I think he's really good fun. So anyway, in the case of Waitress, what then happens is that she then proceeds to have an inappropriate relationship with her doctor whilst trying to get away from her hideous husband and meanwhile dealing with the issues of pregnancy. Now, some people have said, oh, it's terribly twee. It's kind of, you know, it's completely unbelievable. It's set in this sort of mom's apple pie world and you don't believe that her spouse is abusive. Well, I think this is all nonsense. It is basically a sort of, you know, an apple pie fairy tale. And I thought it was rather sweet and rather charming. There are things wrong with it. Occasionally, the writing isn't, I mean, it's not, for example, as sharp as some of the Hal Hartley work. And yet, it is a film about a pregnant woman in which the pregnant woman is seen to be, you know, a romantic lead. I mean, the doctor falls in, but that's, you know, that's central. It's about her relationship with her husband and her work and her child. I think there are certain things in it that, although it wants a little bit too much to you know, to be truthful in that sort of slightly heart-wrenching way, I think there are things in it that are observant. I think it's a very good portrayal of her hideous husband, whose main worry with her being pregnant is that she won't love him as much as she'll love the baby. He doesn't realise that she doesn't love him anyway because he is a total pig of a man and deserves to be left at the earliest possible opportunity. And I have to say, notwithstanding the tragedy of the filmmaker themselves not being here to see this success, I was genuinely touched by it. I thought it was a charming and interesting little film, and I cannot understand why it is that some of the broadsheet reviews have been as harsh on it as they have, because I thought there was a lot to say in its favour. The only one qualifying thing I should say is I tend to love any film which has a sort of 50s-style flavour to it, in which people are working in a diner that's run by a guy with a really, really good DA and a balding quip. So that, I mean, I was kind of sold from the opening.
I think over the last couple of weeks we've seen the soft underbelly of Mark Kermode, and we talked last week about how you said there's nothing greater than crying in a darkened room.
And I did have a crying waitress.
That's the key. If it made you cry, then I want to see it.
But it was one of those classic, you know, tears of joy in the worst. But I did. I mean, I really did. I thought it was really, really, and it's got this lovely ending. And at the end of it, I went, oh, and I could hear other people in the critics in the screening going, oh, no, that's horrible. That's hideous. But I thought, no, it was really, really sweet and really charming.
Okay.
Not wonderful, but really well worth seeing.
Richard in Cardiff said, Dr. Kermode owes me £150. Do you want to hear the rest of the email?
Yeah, I think I need to.
Okay, having been a long-time listener, I place great stock in the good doctor's judgment. The problem is, however, that recently I bought a cinema card which allows me to see as many films as I want. This would be great if it were not for the fact that Mr. Kermode puts me off practically everything that comes out. I therefore calculated he owes me £150. He says, I've deducted £20 as I guess he did stop me from seeing Pirates of the Caribbean. That's not a bad thing. And Peter in Dublin points out Rush Hour 3, not the last of the threequels this summer, The Bourne Ultimatum.
But I should say, because I've seen it, I'm off next week, it opens next week, The Bourne Ultimatum, it's a Paul Greengrass movie, and therefore it's head and shoulders above all the other threequels. I mean, it's, you know, without wishing to blow the gaff, it really, really moves. There's a review in Variety of The Bourne Ultimatum which said if they could distill and bottle what drives this movie, they would have to outlaw it. And it is true. Very few people, well, nobody else, can do that kind of seat-of-your-pants documentary feel that Paul Greengrass can do. And, you know, you sit down at the beginning of The Bourne Ultimatum and he starts running and then he runs and he runs and he runs. And you think, why isn't this just tedious running? And it's because it's a Paul Greengrass movie and it really rocks.
And that's what makes it. Well, listen, he's got a cinema card. You owe him £150. Waitress, we were talking about.
Yes, and I like Waitress. There was two things I wanted to read. There was.
Can I just say before you go on?
Go on.
Graham Gooch just threw you the dirtiest look from behind you, and he's just standing there. He will be back, and he just looked at you as if he's going to grab you by the throat any minute. So let's stick to films, okay?
As I say, it wouldn't be the first time that a sporting legend has grabbed me by the throat. There we go. So no, in the last thing from Waitress, one of the recipes from Waitress, I can't have no affair because it's wrong, and I don't want Earl to kill me. Pie, vanilla custard with banana. Hold the banana. But I mean, you know, it's like anyway. I thought it was funny. So also out this week, and we had. Paul Schrader on the program last week is The Walker. Schrader himself describes this as the fourth part of a story about somebody growing, which starts off with an angry taxi driver because he wrote Taxi Driver. Then the character becomes the narcissistic American gigolo Richard Gere in his finest screen role, I think. Then we have Light Sleeper, which is a drug dealer, an anxious drug dealer. And now we have The Walker. The Walker, played by Woody Harrelson, who is basically a society guy whose job it is to walk around society ladies in Washington, D.C. I mean, that's what he does. He's gay, but he's not necessarily narrowly out, but he is friends with all these women and he's kind of the centre of their world. He has a certain degree of narcissism, except for the fact that he's completely bald and he walks around wearing a wig. And we see a lovely scene which matches that scene in American Gigolo when Richard Gere puts all his fabulous clothes out on the bed, and in the Woody Harrelson scene it ends up with him taking off the wig. And at the centre of it all we have, in a, I think, a very brave performance, very accomplished performance, Woody Harrelson giving it his all. It is very interesting that for women of a certain age working in Hollywood, no matter how good they are, the roles dry up. So whereas it's quite hard to get your male lead, and he did say there's an awful lot of people wouldn't play that character because they won't play a gay character, they're still worried about that. As far as the female characters are concerned, you have this incredible array of talent that's there to be, you know, to be used, and they're really enthusiastic about it. Now, there's good and bad to say about The Walker. I've seen it twice. The first time I saw it, I found it almost too theatrical for its own good, as opposed to something like American Gigolo, which is a very sexy film to watch. I mean, sexy in the proper sense, where, you know, it's like it's attractive and it's alluring and all that sort of stuff. It is actually quite hard at the beginning to get into the world of The Walker. Second time round, I thought it was a much more accomplished film. As with all of the movies in this quadrilogy, if that is it quadrilogy? Quartet. As with all the movies in this quartet, I think that's the correct English word, isn't it?
Quadrilogy doesn't work at all.
No, but it's the Alien quadrilogy, which is why I say that. But they're rubbish, they're Americans. Yeah, so as with all the movies in this quartet, there is a sort of, there's a murder mystery story going on, there's a kind of crime thriller element going on in the background, but it's completely sort of, you know, to the side of what the movie's actually about. The movie is, in the end, a character study, and it's about, once again, the character of God's lonely man to whom Schrader returns again and again and again, and that is his, he writes about that character like nobody else can.
And for that alone, it's worth the ticket price.
It is, it really is. I was also very impressed by just how, you know, how much Woody Harrelson was willing to kind of shed any sense of narcissism to absolutely, you know, play a character who it's very difficult to like, who the tenor of whose voice can be quite annoying. I mean, and he does it really terrifically. And Woody Harrelson's an interesting case because he's done an awful lot of different stuff. You look back at movies like White Men Can't Jump, you look at The People versus Larry Flint, in which he's absolutely terrific. Yep. I mean, you look at Money Train, he's done action, he's done comedy, he's, you know, really bozo comedy. He's worked with the Farrelly brothers, and yet he always surprises me.
Is he one of film's most underrated actors? Because I've seen him a couple of times in the West End as well and been blown away.
You know,
by
I've
his
never seen him on stage. Is he good on stage?
Yeah, I saw him in a two-man play. Now, I'm going to show myself up by not remembering the name. Any Given Day or whatever, he's in Estranged Brother, and his brother comes back to see him, and he's a little then. He's wonderful in that. The other guy was the guy out of Twin Peaks whose name escapes me. You see, that's why I don't do film reviews. But it was a wonderful day out. Then I went to see that last night at the Iguana. Is that the one that's in as well? Yeah. Which I didn't enjoy the play as much, but I enjoyed his performance in it. So yeah, he's got to be one of the most
underrated. You should definitely be a film critic. You should come and go.
Should I fill in for you?
There's that guy, and it's the other guy, and it's directed by that bloke who did that film. I can't remember the name, but he was in it, and it was really good.
Well, here's another. Why are they re-releasing License to Drive? Oh, sorry, License to Wed.
It's
what's
not
that?
A re-release. It's a License to Wed. Here we go. Hold your breath, everyone. License to Wed is that most dreaded of things, a new Robin Williams movie.
Oh.
Robin Williams, I think, is rapidly becoming one of my least favourite human beings, despite the fact there was a period in Robin Williams' life when he was an incredible comedian. Apparently, his personal life was fairly out of control. We don't need to sort of fill in the details there. But he has since sort of slowed down and started making what he thinks, or what his agents think, are family-friendly comedies. Now, get the family-friendly comedy in this. In License to Wed, he plays a priest, a really creepy priest, with a really creepy 12-year-old kid friend who looks like that kid out of The Omen. Yeah. And what he does is marriage guidance counselling. And the way he does marriage guidance, this is before you get married, if you want to get married in his church, you have to go to his counselling classes, he bugs your bedroom and he stalks you. And he goes through all your personal files, and he attempts to break the rest. I mean, you can see the hilarity never ceases.
Oh dear.
You look at films like, you know, 1 Hour Photo, in which he actually plays a slightly psychopath, well, not slightly, a psychopathic character. And he, like so many comedians, there is something about him that is really, really creepy. Hmm. And occasionally, a filmmaker will find a way of exploiting that. But when he just tries to do charming, down-home, lovely, all the rest of it, he just comes across as really slimy, really unpleasant, really, really really kind of your skin starts to crawl. And as this comedy, and I use the word advisedly, unfolds, I was sitting there in the screening with all the rest of the critics, and I promise you, what was starting to happen was people were starting to shrink inside their clothes. Yeah. They were starting to attempt to not make physical contact with anything in the cinema. It was as if you actually felt that touching things at the film would somehow corrupt your skin, and you developed some kind of, you know,
people on first dates doing reverse yawns.
It was mighty, mighty, mighty terrible, and increasingly creepy. And at the end of it, there's an outtakes reel in which you always know that comedy hasn't worked, but at the end they say, here's a bunch of scenes of everyone who made the film really enjoying themselves.
It's
really funny. I'm really glad you had a really good time, because the rest of it was like being at a funeral.
Okay, well listen, I mean, let's say something nice about Robin Williams then. Go back to the days. What's the best Robin Williams film?
Fisher King. And Terry Gilliam was brilliant with Fisher King. Terry Gilliam realised that the thing that with Robin Williams is he has this really manic quality, like he, you know, really, really manic. If you can harness that, it's fantastic. And The Fisher King is a terrific movie, and he pairs him with Jeff Bridges, and it's just a wonderful, and of course Terry Gilliam is one of the great visionary directors.
Okay, well let's say Nanu Nanu then to License to Wed and go on to our final film, Surf's Up. We'll get a minute or two in this.
Okay, so penguins, what is it with penguins? I mean, you know, March of the Penguins, and everyone looks at them and says it's incredible, you can see the, you know, the actions of God in the
which one was the real documentary?
March of the Penguins,
that was good.
Well, you say real documentary, the thing is, in real life I don't think that, as Morgan Freeman's voiceover suggested, these penguins are in love. Look at them expressing the love that they have for the family. For all these myths about penguins, right, they're monogamous. Yeah, they're monogamous year on year. Mick Jagger is monogamous year on year. I'm sorry. That is really nothing to write home about. Okay. So anyway, so firstly they become these kind of new deities. Then Happy Feet comes along. Happy Feet, it's the animated penguins. You know what? We should really, really be nice to flightless seabirds, but only if they can tap dance. Because if they can tap dance, they're cute and cuddly.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, you didn't see Happy Feet.
Not animated. I'd like to see it in real life.
Yeah, I think if you saw it in real life, then you would really need to desperately get...
Check my drink.
If that does happen, you've really got to knock off the Alco Pops. And so now, here comes Surf's Up. So this time, they're surfing penguins.
Yep.
At the beginning of the movie, a lot of people have said, one of the you know, really interesting innovations of this film, which is co-directed by the co-director of Toy Story 2. You got that?
Yeah.
Co-directed by the co-director of Toy Story.
Did they put that in the poster?
No, I don't think it would fit. Okay. It'll say, like, from the creators of every film you ever liked, somebody who once worked on it knew somebody who worked on this. It's like that, okay? So, at the very beginning, it's like a sort of reality documentary. And they're interviewing these people about surfing. The story is there's a young surfer. He's in love with this surfing legend, the Big Z. The Big Z has disappeared. Nobody knows where he's gone. He's voiced and studied by Jeff Bridges. Obviously fantastic. And it's done like a kind of like a pseudo-documentary. People say, oh, this is really great. Hang about a minute. Aardman Animations, Creature Comforts. I think I saw this gag done 10 years ago by them in plasticine. I got nothing against Surf's Up. It's just not great. However, of all the kids' drivel that's out at the moment, it's the least terrible of the not great films.
Well, Mark, thank you very much. We get through the top 10. We get through 5 films. 30 enjoyed that.